Hi, my name is Ari Satok, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, Once Upon a Conversation. I'm an author and an educator living in New York City, and I've recently embarked on a journey to interview 100 interesting people and share those interviews with my listeners. The aim is simple. People are full of wisdom, and so my goal in these interviews is to tease that wisdom out to then share it with others, since wisdom can inspire us, open our hearts, change the way we see the world or ourselves. I'm extremely lucky to have really interesting people lined up to join me in these 100 conversations, and I'm excited today to be interviewing Alyssa Petersell. Alyssa Petersell is the founder and CEO of My Wellbeing, a platform that helps connect therapy seekers with therapists and coaches. Upon browsing their website, I learned that they've helped over 250,000 people connect with care, which is really remarkable. My Wellbeing also does other things, including curating meaningful content about mental health and stress relief. And though obviously My Wellbeing has become the beautiful work of many people, it's inspiring to know that it all stemmed from Alyssa's vision. I first connected with Alyssa more than 8 years ago, I think, when we were both recent college grads writing books. I've since been inspired from afar watching the direction her path has taken, and I'm particularly inspired because her work makes a difference in the lives of so many people going through mental health challenges, and so many people just trying to live with a sense of wellness and balance in a world and a society that can often make that really hard. So Alyssa, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to primarily focus our conversation on mental health today, but our connection is rooted in the fact that I think 8 or 9 years ago, we were both working on book projects shortly after graduating college. And so I want to start there by asking, what motivated you to write a book? And could you share with everyone listening what that project was all about?
Definitely. One of my first careers, one of my first jobs after school was a community organizing position with a children's hospital in Chicago. And I was working day in, day out, bringing together different stakeholders to try to align everyone on a shared mission to reduce violence and improve youth health in Chicago. And while that was incredible, I struggled with some of the bureaucracy of the hospital system and some of the time it would take between starting an effort and actually seeing the impact on the other side. And really, really big institutional change does sometimes take time. And a little bit of age and perspective has definitely informed that even more. But at the time, I was really hungry to make a bigger impact faster. So I launched a Kickstarter to raise about a year's worth of living expenses to move to Hungary and interview third-generation Holocaust survivors, so the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors in Budapest and Hungary, and learn more about how they were redefining and re-enlivening Jewish life in Budapest despite really challenging external environments like unhealthy economy, joblessness, spiking costs, far-right politics and government. And it was incredibly inspiring to have the chance to be with those folks and share their stories. And one of the core goals was to actually drive more awareness and even more funding to some of the efforts that they were doing.
And what'd you learn from, I've done a lot of interview projects of just the experience of sitting with people and hearing their stories and being trusted with their stories?
For me, it was incredible. I've always been really drawn to hearing stories, sharing stories. I enjoy listening. I enjoy speaking. I think when people have the opportunity to be in a shared presence and to see and affirm each other's experiences, that ultimately is the most healing, which fundamentally drove me into the field of mental health. I found that at the time I was doing the interviews and not infrequently some trauma or things that were challenging or difficult would come up. And I was really craving the intersection of listening, hearing, and sharing with tools and perspective and coping mechanisms so that I could go that much deeper with someone and really help them in healing and in moving forward. So following the book project is when I returned to the States. I returned to Chicago specifically, started working in the hospitality industry while I was editing and publishing and promoting, and then ultimately moved back to New York to get my master's in social work with the interest and the original plan of becoming a therapist in private practice while writing. And it was once I started training as a therapist that I started looking for my own therapist and learned the hard way how many obstacles stood in that path, which really motivated me to start my well-being.
I love the fact that already has emerged just this idea that our paths don't always end up going exactly the way we thought. In fact, if you asked any of, let's just say, my college classmates, I don't think any of us are in exactly the place that we thought we would end up going. And I wonder if just for a second, before we move forward in the narrative, if you could speak to just that idea about the paths that we all walk being windy and perhaps unexpected and unpredictable and how you've experienced that.
Absolutely. Most of the chapters of, at minimum, my professional career, until my well-being, felt a little eclectic and disconnected at best. And there's definitely, at least in the US, but in a lot of places, a tremendous amount of pressure on young people to figure out exactly what their professional trajectory is going to be to a T and to have that define them and be one of the first things that comes up in conversation. And what I learned over time is that different experiences really exist to teach you something, and there's something to learn in every conversation and in every experience. And ultimately, the journey is what we're here for as opposed to the destination. I don't think we ever wake up and feel like we've quote unquote made it, even if we have achieved some of the milestones or accolades that we once really dreamed about or set out for. There's always that next learning opportunity. There's always that next relationship. I think the same is also true in our personal life. Sometimes, especially in some of our first relationships, some of our first really deep friendships, some of our first really deep loves, if we ever lose that relationship or that love or that person through a breakup, through a death, through a separation, through a betrayal, that can feel really groundless. And it can feel like, oh, I invested all this time and headspace into this person and now I don't have them. What was the point? And I think truly we, throughout the journey, that experience, that person, that perspective will always be a part of us and will inform how we move forward. And I think it's in that integration that we really find meaning and fulfillment and are able to be more present and more grounded in the here and now, as opposed to constantly orienting around the future and around what's next.
I agree. I think sort of related on a point you made about where even when you achieve some of the things you wanted to achieve, always new things to learn or new places to go. I think we cause ourselves a lot of pain when we convince ourselves that other people are somehow at this point where they have exactly what they want or they're exactly where they wanted to be. And I wonder if you could share even just a short thought of how to start liberating ourselves from those thinking habits that you look at someone, social media being the classic place where you look at someone, but could be in your personal life. You meet someone and in your mind, you just spin that narrative. They're exactly where they want to be, or they've got that elusive level of success, accomplishment.
Yeah. It's important to remember that there's always more to the story. There might be more good or more that's quote unquote enviable. There might be a lot of pain. There might be a lot of loss. Any narrative, any photo, any quote or award is literally only showing that snippet of time and that moment of time. There's a lot of also hard work and sacrifice that goes into certain things, and there's different timelines for everyone. So I think some of the ways to break out of that headspace, first and foremost, is to really practice orienting around self as much as possible. So really looking inward, thinking about setting manageable goals and tiny, tiny, tiny steps for one's self that someone has control over. So for example, I think one of the first things to do there is notice what's the theme of things that is bringing up either some social anxiety or comparative anxiety or envy or jealousy when looking at others. So is it body image? Is it career? Is it relationship status? You know, whatever it is, just be mindful, ideally with trying to be aware and trying to reduce judgment as much as possible. Those things are very normal and they're very okay. The more awareness we have over those themes, the more we can look inward and say, hey, if I were to wave a magic wand, where would I like to be myself in that theme? And how can I start to plant seeds for these small incremental daily steps to start to get there? And then over time, I think looking at what those goals are for yourself and asking yourself, hey, am I showing up for myself? Am I doing the things that I had committed to for myself to make progress in this area? And then I think if you're not, is it because there is something concrete standing in your way? Maybe you bit off a little more than time or resources would allow, which is also okay. You can be iterative about adjusting what the goals are. Or if you are, I think it's really important to also celebrate those milestones. So if you chip off daily or weekly or monthly goals and 3 months go by, and if career was the thing, and say you want to start your own podcast, maybe the first step is identifying about what, right? And maybe in the first month, it's really doing some soul searching or some informational interviews or coffees to try to narrow down on what those topics are. So maybe week one, it's make a list of 20 possible topics. And then week two is turn 20 into 10. And then week three is like you pick the topic. And week four, you title it, right? I think when you have that title, you really have to lean in and celebrate and honor that, knowing that maybe a couple weeks or a couple months later, you're going to be that person who's posting or who's looking like you have it all together and people are really in awe of that milestone you've achieved, when you are aware and you know that it's a series of really small steps and really small accomplishments that you held yourself accountable to and you showed up for, and you showed up for yourself in that way.
Really helpful thinking about small incremental goals as opposed to sort of big picture dream. I wish I was in this place. How do I get there ASAP? I want to go back to, you were mentioning about your own experience seeking therapy and that it was very difficult. And can you talk a little bit about how that led you into what has blossomed in all kinds of ways, but into the project that you lead now?
Of course. I was in my first year of graduate school in social work school at NYU training as a therapist. And I must have called 45 people. Maybe three of them called me back, and maybe one of them actually had the same price on the phone that was on their website. And, you know, just learning the hard way that I wasn't actively in an anxious or depressive episode. I was in school learning all the acronyms and having all the information at my fingertips. So I had all the tools and the time and determination necessary to find this person. And still, it took me 6 to 12 months to really land on someone that I felt rapport with or that I felt a connection with. And one of the biggest requirements in that process was the patience and determination to keep reaching out and a relative degree of optimism that the person is out there. And then ultimately, an integration with my career. It was important to me as a therapist, as a coming soon to be therapist, that I was in my own therapy. And if that wasn't integral to my career, would my determination or my commitment to this process have been as strong? Probably not. So I also had a lot of empathy for folks that it's not as integral to their career necessarily, who might be actively in an episode of anxiety or depression or another mental health condition, where one of the first things to go is your executive functioning. You don't have the optimism. You don't have the determination or the follow through. And it's not because you're a bad person or because you're weak or flawed, but it's because that is part of the condition. And it's one of the symptoms, and it is something that you go through when you're feeling unwell. So I realized that the way that the system currently existed would not work, especially for the people in most need. So I wanted to create something that was easier, way more personalized, and that ultimately would take some of that responsibility of the executive functioning, that if you showed up and said, yeah, I do want to start therapy, and shared a couple preferences about what you were looking for, we would do the searching, the confirming, and we would send to you folks that were aligned with the preferences or requirements or needs that you had. And the next thing you had to do was show up.
So to really simplify it, make it easier for people.
Yeah.
I want to zoom out for a second to ask, if you had to say in one sentence, I'm sure you could speak for an hour about this, but if you had to boil it down to one sentence, what do you think the role of the therapist is?
The role of the therapist. So that's a really hard question to sum up in one sentence. I could probably speak for hours upon hours about it. I think I'm going to say longer to externally process, and then we can winnow it down to one sentence. I think that a really good therapist helps someone realize and crystallize and see insight that a lot of times already exists somewhere within them, but for a multitude of reasons, they're not seeing it or feeling it. So I think it's extremely reflective, attuned, and it's creating a safe space from within someone can do that work. Because a lot of times we're not safe on the streets of New York City or really anywhere. We're not safe at work. We're not safe, you know, we have to have a little bit of a face on. We have to be performing to some degree. And if we're always on or we always have our walls up, of course we can't access the really deep inner workings. And not only can we not access it, we don't always know what we're looking for. We don't always have the flashlight. We don't always have the map. So I think a therapist really provides that blueprint and that guide, as well as the safety and security within which someone can really explore some of the things that have A, made them who they are, and B, sometimes are causing a lot of pain and are things that they might be ready to let go of, or they might be ready to reframe, but don't know how to on their own.
Mm-hmm. So my mind went to a different question as you were speaking about. So the therapist has this role to sort of let the walls come down and let us have that kind of safety. I'm just curious, your association, an experience in your life where you have felt the walls come down. Doesn't have to be related to therapy. It could be a group you've been a part of. It could be a summer camp. Like, it could be anything, but just where you felt like your own walls just came down.
Mm. The first thing that came to mind is therapy. I've been in therapy now since graduate school with a variety of different therapists. And one of the reasons I have seen a variety is because if my well-being has taught me nothing else, it's that there are hundreds of different kinds of therapy, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of different kinds of therapists. And it's not the same at all, but much like friendship or dating, someone's personality matters, your rapport matters, your chemistry matters. So I've had wildly different experiences with each therapist that depends on their training and the tools that they provide, but it also depends on just how our unique makeup is interacting with each other. And that said, the therapist I work with now is relatively body-based. And I have learned over time that due to conditioning to society, I'm a pretty type A person. I tend to be pretty cognitive. I'm definitely a recovered perfectionist, I would say. I'm much more comfortable with imperfection now than I was growing up. I'd say I'm a recovering workaholic. I have a lot of relationship with long hours, achieving, that I'm much more comfortable now with rest and self-care and a healthier, holistic lifestyle than I once had. And some of the ways that I got there was working with a body-based therapist who helped me get out of my head and access parts of my experience and parts of my memories and parts of where I was storing stress that thinking and verbal processing alone wouldn't access. So that was really big for me. And I, even in graduate school, didn't necessarily know that existed. And it took really having exposure to a lot of different kinds of therapists to say, hey, I'm kind of interested in that. I want to give that a try. And that is something that I would definitely encourage of anyone who's listening, is even if you're in a really engaged relationship with a therapist, that's amazing. You can see more than one, believe it or not. And you can go through different chapters of seeing different people for different reasons. In the same way that for your physical health, you might go to a cycling class, you might have a really consistent relationship with a community at a gym for a long time, and then go try karate or go try, you know, there's different things that light up different parts of our brain and different parts of our experience that I think are all really worthwhile.
That's a really helpful frame. So it sounds like the body-based therapist right now, you're saying, is a space that lets you feel that,
yeah,
that safety. I have so many questions, and I'm going to keep us within our time, but you talked about two things that I think about a lot, perfectionism and workaholism. We both live in New York City, which I cannot compare it to all places in the world, but certainly compared to many of the other places I've visited, there's a in my opinion, uniquely workaholic culture to this place. And I want to actually come in from the other side, thinking about achievement and success. What do you think for you, and then we'll broaden it, when you're working really hard and you want to achieve something, what do you think is the biggest thing that's motivating you?
That's a great question. Impact is a really big one for me. I think really wanting to help people was a huge drive in starting My Wellbeing, for example, and it's a huge drive in what keeps me going when things are tough. And entrepreneurship of any size, there's peak highs and there's valleys. And I think in the valleys, there needs to be an answer to that question you just asked. Why are you doing this in the first place? And the more in tuned you are with that, the more you can even cognitively, you know, remind yourself of that even when emotionally it doesn't feel as resonant. So for me, impact and helping people is really big. I've had my own experiences with anxiety and trauma, and I really want anyone who is experiencing feelings of hopelessness or loneliness or panic to have tools and people at their fingertips that can help. So that is a big one for me. And I think in general, with regard to achievement, the answers are so multifaceted. I think that there's a tremendous amount of societal influence that I couldn't possibly ignore. I did grow up in New York. I did grow up in a really high-performing family that set high expectations for each other. And especially the youngest versions of ourselves are very little sponges soaking up all the different opinions and values that we're surrounded by. And that influences us tremendously. I think my parents their families were heavily impacted by the Holocaust, having survived that and then building a life of privilege. From that, I think I carry a tremendous sense of responsibility of making something of that and feeling like, oh, if we were so lucky as to have that opportunity and if our family is so lucky to continue that lineage, let's make it worth it. Let's help as many people as we can. Let's try to prevent as much trauma as we can. And then I do think on some level there is, I'll mention again, in the US, definitely in a lot of places, less so in others, there's a certain degree of social pressure. It's very socially applauded to have career-oriented accolades or to, you know, be able to post that thing or this photo or et cetera. And I think for a long time, that felt really good. It releases a lot of dopamine. And that can be really encouraging. You want that next dopamine hit. So now those dopamine hits come from a lot of places. For some people, it's likes on a photo. For other people, it's a career achievement. For other people, it's physical dopamine of exercise or of intimacy with a partner. So I think for me, the dopamine from a really young age came from accomplishment. And it took a long time for me to really separate the physical joy of that and the physical chemical hit of that and to orient around, hey, that's not the only way to have that feeling or that fulfillment. And even if that feels good, doesn't mean it's who you are.
To steer us back to one of those motivations you just talked about, which is the impact piece. I said it in the intro, it's amazing the impact that your organization has had already. And also cool in the way that it's an impact that like you will never be able to track the actual like exactly what happens of all the therapists who have met other, you know, who have met people that were connected because of you. There's like a beauty in that, right? Of like what happens from my well-being goes out into the world and changes people's hearts or patterns of thinking in ways that will always be beyond trackability. And my question is, I'm sure there've been so many precious moments of seeing the way that your journey has changed an individual's life or, you know, changed the way groups of people are thinking about therapy, stigma. What have been one or two highs for you on that impact piece of just like seeing your work doing something in the world and you go, that's the dream. That's what I was hoping it would do.
One recent high is I went recently to provide feedback on a startup panel where I was with two other folks and we were listening to rising companies share about their concept and how much progress they had made and some of their milestones ahead and some of the obstacles that faced them. And when I arrived, two of the other people that I was going to be providing feedback with let me know that either they found a therapist through My Wellbeing or they helped someone in their family find a therapist through My Wellbeing. And it was someone that they had stayed with for over 3 years at this point. And it was really meaningful to their life. And they inspired other people to go to therapy because they were making positive change and showing a lot of growth. And then that modeling showed other people what therapy can do and also what investing in yourself can do. And that was a huge high for me because it came out of relative nowhere. I wasn't expecting it. I was showing up in a space of providing a service, and to have received that gift as a surprise was really meaningful. And I also think, you know, another high is that in that same moment, I never got into this work and I never would have thought how much the work would change me. And as I was, you know, providing feedback to some of these companies that were a couple years younger, I realized how much learning I had to do throughout, and I'm still doing. And it circles back to what we had said earlier about even when you get to a certain point, that when you're looking ahead, that point feels so far away. Then when you get there and you're looking back and you're like, oh, that thing I was worried about seems so small now. And you're looking at it the next point, right? So that was a moment where I looked back and some of the questions that they had were questions that I 1000% had at the time that now I have some space from and some perspective on and even some skill in. And that was really powerful and really moving to viscerally experience that passage of time and that leveling up in skill and perspective. And when I first started, I wouldn't have even known to really think about the growth and potential on a personal level. But that's been really rewarding along the way.
And such a note for anyone who's listening of just to notice the progress that you've made. It is so easy to not notice at all the progress that you've made, whatever the area of life in which you're trying to make progress in. I want to ask some questions that are kind of out there at the edge of creative thinking. You think a lot about mental health. Before I actually get to that, my first question is, I read so many articles that talk about a mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. I saw the Secretary General of the UN was quoted as saying, we're living through a moment of global mental health crisis. I was reading a Washington Post article, a recent one, that was titled, The Crisis of Student Mental Health is Much Vaster Than We Realize. And my first question is just, is that a helpful framing? I haven't thought about it enough to actually know what my own answer, but when you hear the word crisis, do you feel like we are living through a crisis? Do you think it feel like that's distinct now compared to when you started this work? Do you think in your own adult life, you've always thought that America was living through some degree of mental health crisis? How do you reflect on that?
What's funny is I have gotten to a place where I almost always try to shy away from panic initiating words like crisis. However, in this case, I do think we're living through a mental health crisis. I think that it preceded my time, and I think we're going to make a lot of progress, which is really exciting because mental health is getting a lot more attention and there's a lot of people with a lot of power and privilege who are starting to pay attention. But why I'm comfortable using the urgency of the word crisis is it is a crisis, I think, and there is a pretty direct correlation for younger demographics, younger generations, experiences of mental health are spiking faster and in more severity. And sometimes folks ask, and it's a valid question, is there more mental illness or are we just talking about it more? Are we more comfortable being open about it? So the stats appear to be higher. And I think that both might be happening, but frankly, you know, up until relatively recently, we didn't have social media. So even to your question earlier of it's relatively easy to fall into a trap of comparing self to other, feeling as though everyone else has everything figured out. You're the only one. You feel like you're falling behind. You feel like you're not doing enough. I definitely think that's exacerbated by social media. I also think, in general, the internet, social media gives us access to way more news and information. So our minds and our bodies are activated for a much higher percentage of time than only when we were watching the news or watching TV or reading the newspaper. And then otherwise, we were relatively off screen. And it gave the body a chance to be present or to reset or to be in direct response to something in the immediate environment, which could have still been scary, but then you're seeing the threat and you're engaging with it, as opposed to a lot of the threats that we entertain and are thinking about and are trying to tackle now are often much, much bigger than ourselves. Climate change or, you know, natural disasters, terrorism. And I think that those things can feel really overwhelming, and we have way more access to seeing them and engaging with them near constantly. So I think there's a pretty direct correlation there. And I'd say we are seeing that rates of anxiety and depression are skyrocketing, and really fatal consequences of that close behind them, rates of suicidality, rates of hospitalizations. And that's definitely something that we need to be, as much resources are speaking out about mental health and are pointing toward supporting more businesses or supporting more initiatives, there needs to be way more.
I think that's helpful. Also, I love that phrase, panic initiating words. I've never heard it before, but I feel like it's a helpful frame. And you mentioned that now there are more high profile people who are speaking out about this or thinking about this. If you imagine for a second that you got a call from the US government, they created a new cabinet position today. It's called Secretary of Mental Health, and they deputized you to the role. What would be some of the first things you would do in that position? You've got a national position.
Yeah. One of the first things I would do would be to do a deep dive on what's being done on a local and really high scale level. One of the things I learned early in community organizing is that one of the worst things we can do is try to recreate the wheel when there's already really good work happening. What happens then is there's a lot of teams and resources doing duplicative work in silos that can only reach a certain level of impact compared to if all those stakeholders were to come together, how much louder would that voice be? How much bigger would that impact be? So the first thing I would do would try to identify who those leaders are who've been doing the work, and could they use additional spotlight, additional resources? Could they use a bridge to connect with each other? Do they know about each other? Are there things that can happen across state lines or across country lines that would be influential? And then beyond that, one of the areas where I see a tremendous amount of opportunity is trying to educate and support from as young an age as possible. So I know that when I was young, no one talked to me about what mental health is. Anxiety, stress management, I don't know. I learned math. I learned social studies. I learned English. But no one told me how to breathe. No one told me, you know, hey, when you start to get overwhelmed, here's a couple things you could try. And I think the younger we address those feelings being normal, so you could expect them, you can anticipate them, so that when they come up, you're not abruptly shocked and feeling out of body and feeling lost. And the more we can provide concrete tools to use in that moment, and also access to tools that you can use to go that much further and to connect in community and enable that to scale. So those are a couple of things I'd be looking at. And I know that there are folks working on that, which is really encouraging. So would be that much more motivated to learn more about that work and to help accelerate it.
Who's one person you've met, and I'm sure you've met dozens, but in your mental health related work, that just really inspires you, an initiative they're leading or something they're putting on the ground? And maybe different than, I'm sure you've met so many therapists themselves who are doing like amazing work, but I'm curious if there's someone else that in the mental health space, you're like, whoa,
yeah.
I wish more people knew about this.
Two come to mind, and already like a third is like, my mind's just like buzzing because there's so many that I think in their own way. For everyone listening, what I would say is that there's no quote unquote right way to make impact. And I think one of the best ways is to be reflective about what is one of your unique strengths? What would you consider to be within your quote unquote zone of genius, which might be what is one thing that when you're doing it, the time just kind of seems to pass and it feels natural and you're just happen to be good at it. You're better at it than other people. You don't really know why. Maybe you're a little humble about it, but you just are. I'd say think about that and how can you leverage that for good. And the reason I say that is because some of the examples that come up, it's not necessarily what you'd expect as who those leaders would be. So one is I recently watched Selena Gomez's documentary, which is all about her mental health journey. And toward the end, it really showcases the work that she's doing to try to weave more mental health and education into educational curriculums. So similar to what I was just saying, I think she's really trying to spearhead or further fuel some of those efforts. And really at a foundational level, she's had a career as an actor, she's had a career as a musician. A lot of people might say, you've been incredibly successful. And does acting or music have anything directly to do with mental health? Who are you to be leading this effort? Right. But she's had this experience and she's made it a priority to use her platform and use her influence to try to make a big impact and try to make change. So I think that's very inspiring for me. I would say the same is true of Lizzo. She's been through a lot and she's tried to make every single one of her lyrics be inspiring, be supportive, so that if something goes viral on the radio, you're not necessarily only singing about dancing at the club, you're actually singing about how you talk to yourself. And if a song is stuck in your head, you're telling yourself 100 times a day that you're special, because that's, you know, a song of hers that was very successful and went viral. And how amazing that now there's a whole generation of people who are making their lunch and singing to themselves that they're special instead of, you know, anything else that the lyric could have been. And then on a smaller scale, the Mayfair Group is a clothing line that inspires me constantly. Their founder's name is Sam, and she is an influencer of her own right. And I follow her stories pretty closely on Instagram. I follow the Mayfair Group, and all of their clothing has very supportive mental health affirmations on it. So one set is an empathy set. If you're walking around, it just has this big colorful word empathy on it. And I wore that on a flight recently home from Canada. And I had four different employees at the airport tell me that having seen that word in those big bright colors really made their day, made them feel better, which never would have happened if I was wearing the gray sweatshirt that I'm wearing right now, just a plain gray, solid piece of clothing. So I think that is something that speaks to like what is the type of thing that you want to do and how can you add your spin to it? Because who would say that a clothing line is going to make a huge mental health impact, right? And then the Mayfair Group has actually gone that much further, and they've donated to My Wellbeing a percentage of their profit so that they could support free access to mental health care for people who couldn't afford it, which is amazing. And, you know, a lot of companies don't think about that. So those are a couple of examples that I'd say are people that I really look up to.
I'm just curious. That's a beautiful concept. So empathy is one. Are they mostly words, phrases, combination of things?
A lot of things. And they're very, very fashion forward. Another one, they had a line called The Art of Connection. And you can imagine on the back of a sweatshirt, it said essentially, you know, how to connect. And maybe one was text a friend something you love about them. Two was, you know, smile at a stranger on the street. And I'm making up those exact words. I could look on their website for what it actually is. But you can imagine, like, if you're riding the subway and someone's wearing that sweatshirt and you read the bullet points, right? And you're like, oh, I am going to text a friend right now. Or like, I'm going to smile at that person, or even compliment the person wearing that sweatshirt. And all of a sudden, there's two or three or five people whose day that one sweatshirt has changed and has improved.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly agree that words can make a difference, and you could put them on shirts. There's so many different ways that words can make a difference. I think a lot about our self-talk and how we talk to ourselves. I'm in a meditation course right now where they're constantly teaching us to refer to ourselves as sweetheart. That's sort of the language of the course. Sweetheart, it is what it is. Sweetheart, it will be okay. I'm curious for you, is there any particularly supportive phrase, mantra, or something that you come back to a lot, or a quote?
There are a lot. I admittedly am an avid Peloton user. Often the strength workouts, even as often as the bike rides. The building I live in right now, I'm very lucky, has a bike that I can use. And Jess Sims and Tunde are two of the instructors who I really, really like. And part of why I like them is they infuse a lot of these mantras. And something that Jess Sims, that I first learned during the pandemic, she said, "This is tough, but you are tougher." I use that all the time. where if I encounter something that feels like it's stretching me or that it's beyond my current capacity, or I don't totally know what the answers are, it is tough. And I don't want to minimize that it's not tough. You know, I don't just want to say, oh, it's no big deal, because I think that's a little dismissive. Sometimes it is a big deal, but I'm tougher. And I also, another one is, I've survived 100% of my hardest days, which is to acknowledge things have been hard. I've been in dark periods, and there were days that I did not know that there'd be a brighter day. I didn't know what the other side would look like. I didn't know how I was going to dig myself out of something. And I did, because I'm resourceful and because I have a lot of support in my world. And, and I think those reminders are also, again, it's not saying that the thing is not tough or that you don't have reason to feel stressed or anxious or lonely, but that even in those feelings that you still have, you know, the power up at, or, you know, the will to make it through.
I love that quote of, I have survived 100% of my toughest days. We don't have much time left, so I'm going to angle these last few questions to try to be as useful to either A, someone who right now is going through a really difficult mental health moment, or someone supporting someone going through a difficult mental health moment. I'm going to say before I ask these questions, all of these questions deserve hours of reflection. These are not questions that truly can be answered in a sentence, and yet I think there will be something helpful in you giving a short, succinct answer to them without at all pretending that that is sufficient to the question. The first is this: if you were given the chance to give a speech or write a letter, your choice, that would go out to every high schooler in America going through depression or anxiety, I'll say specifically, I wonder, just from the heart, from the gut, what you might want to put on that letter or what you might want to say in that speech.
In the spirit of succinctness, I would say that you are not alone and you don't know yet, but this will be an integral part of who you are and will make you stronger.
That's helpful. If you could similarly, you could send a letter or give a speech to anyone who is supporting someone who's in a really dark, difficult moment in their lives. And I feel like that could be a whole other interview, thinking about the people who are supporting folks that are in tough places. What would you say to that person?
I would say to make sure, be specific about the ways in which you would like to support this person. So you're going to listen, you're going to call and listen X amount of times a week. You're going to be really present when you're with this person. You're going to direct them to a certain amount of resources, but to also first and foremost, make sure that you do respect any amount of time or any boundaries that you need to make sure that you are healthy. Because once you start burning out on that care providing, both of you will be very unwell. And to make sure, so to speak, you put your own oxygen mask on first.
I am curious, not because this will apply to everybody who's listening, but what has been one book that has been helpful to you in a tough time, knowing that the art and the books that help people are different? It's not one size fits all recommendations.
So many books. It Didn't Start With You is a huge one for me.
Do you know who the author is? Or otherwise, if people just look it up, It Didn't Start With You.
Oh, I'm actually staring at it. Mark Wallen.
I think it's extremely important. We talked about this earlier, to celebrate our wins and be proud of our progress and be proud of the ways we show up in the world. What is one practical way that you do that, that you know, some practice that you implement to celebrate wins that, like I've been saying, maybe would be helpful to someone in a difficult spot to celebrate their own wins?
I really try to reduce when I am in the moment of a win, or when I've acknowledged or noticed a win, I try to create space to be with that feeling and to repeat to myself internally that win and that feeling, how that feels in that moment, to realize that and to really be present with that warmth or light or feeling of accomplishment versus racing off immediately to the next thing?
Related to these questions, especially for people who are going through a difficult time, a lot of people who are going through a difficult time, I think, feel a lot of guilt in their minds. They don't want to be a burden to someone else. They don't want to take too much energy or effort from others. And that causes a lot of people to not share how they're feeling and just kind of say, I'm fine. I'm doing okay. What could you say about being vulnerable and asking for help?
A lot of people want to be needed and feel a lot closer to you and feel a lot better themselves when they're let in. So I'd say often opening up to others about what's really going on is a gift to them more so than a burden. And they may or may not be going through something similar or have gone through something similar. So you could be granting them permission to be open and honest with you as well, which could be really supportive for them.
I love that insight, thinking that sometimes opening up to others actually is a gift to them. And I think what you're saying about the human desire impulse to want to be able to be helpful and to want to be able to share of what you've experienced. I'm going to move to our final question. I've been asking lots of people that I've been interviewing through this project this question, and it's been yielding all kinds of fascinating, very different answers because the people I've been interviewing have been very different people. And the question is as follows. It's a bit of an imagination question. And it's an intense one. I'm prefacing it by saying that. If 100 years from now, when you and I are both long gone from this world, there exists somewhere in this world your tombstone. And let's imagine a world there's a new practice where before you die, it's your responsibility to write the inscription you want on it that in some way sums up what you hope you contributed to the world or what you hope your life could teach others. At this moment in time, Alyssa of 2023, what do you think you would want written on that tombstone?
That's a really good question. At this moment in time, would want something along the lines of, you know, Alyssa, by having met or known Alyssa, or by having interacted with, you know, any of the things that I've initiated putting out into the world, I have become more myself and been able to, lead a life that I'm really proud of. So Alyssa's helped, you know, X others do that.
Well, I can say with certainty that there's probably so many people around the world who would already be saying that. So I want to close this interview, first of all, by thanking you for your openness, for your willingness to share with such richness from the heart. So I'm grateful for that. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
My joy. And I want to also thank anyone who is listening. I'm really appreciative of you taking the time. I hope you'll listen to more episodes of Once Upon a Conversation. I have genuinely been inspired and nourished by every one of the conversations I've had. And so I hope you'll choose to encounter the wisdom, but really just the humanness of all the people I've been lucky enough to talk to through this project. So thank you again for tuning in.